Welcome to Quantum Magazine's Science Podcast. Come for the science, stay for the stories. For news, interviews, videos, graphics, and more, visit quantummagazine.org. This week on the podcast, in the quest for a theory of everything, a new generation of string theorists is starting to borrow some ideas and methods from an unlikely source. But what good is a theory of everything if it can't be tested? In part two, we explore falsifiability and the nature of scientific evidence. First, String Theory Meets Loop Quantum Gravity by Sabine Hossenfelder. 8 decades have passed since physicists realized that the theories of quantum mechanics and gravity don't fit together, and the puzzle of how to combine the two remains unsolved. In recent decades, researchers have pursued the problem in 2 separate programs, string theory and loop quantum gravity, that are widely considered incompatible by their practitioners. But now, some scientists argue that joining forces is the way forward. Among the attempts to unify quantum theory and gravity, string theory has attracted the most attention. Its premise is simple. Everything is made of tiny strings. The strings may be closed unto themselves or have loose ends. They can vibrate, stretch, join, or split. And in these manifold appearances lie the explanations for all phenomena we observe, including matter and space-time. Loop quantum gravity, by contrast, is concerned less with the matter that inhibits space-time than with the quantum properties of space-time itself. In loop quantum gravity, or LQG, space-time is a network. The smooth background of Einstein's theory of gravity is replaced by nodes and links to which quantum properties are assigned. In this way, space is built up of discrete chunks. LQG is in large part a study of these chunks. This approach has long been thought incompatible with string theory. Indeed, the conceptual differences are obvious and profound. For starters, LQG studies bits of space-time, whereas string theory investigates the behavior of objects within space-time. Specific technical problems separate the fields. String theory requires that space-time have 10 dimensions. LQG doesn't work in higher dimensions. String theory also implies the existence of supersymmetry, in which all known particles have yet undiscovered partners. Supersymmetry isn't a feature of LQG. These and other differences have split the theoretical physics community into deeply divergent camps. Conferences have segregated, said Jorge Pullen, a physicist at Louisiana State University and co-author of an LQG textbook. Loopy people go to loopy conferences. Stringy people go to stringy conferences. They don't even go to physics conferences anymore. I think it's unfortunate that it developed this way. But a number of factors may be pushing the camps closer together. New theoretical findings have revealed potential similarities between LQG and string theory. A young generation of string theorists has begun to look outside string theory for methods and tools that might be useful in the quest to understand how to create a theory of everything. And a still raw paradox involving black holes and information loss has given everyone a fresh dose of humility. Moreover, in the absence of experimental evidence for either string theory or LQG, mathematical proof that the two are in fact opposite sides of the same coin would bolster the argument that physicists are progressing toward the correct theory of everything. Combining LQG and string theory would truly make it the only game in town. An effort to solve some of LQG's own internal problems has led to the first surprising link with string theory. Physicists who study LQG lack a clear understanding of how to zoom out from their network of space-time chunks and arrive at a large-scale description of space-time that dovetails with Einstein's general theory of relativity, our best theory of gravity. More worrying still, their theory can't reconcile the special case in which gravity can be neglected. It's a malaise that befalls any approach reliant on chunking up space-time. In Einstein's theory of special relativity, an object will appear to contract depending on how fast an observer is moving relative to it. This contraction also affects the size of space-time chunks, which are then perceived differently by observers with different velocities. The discrepancy leads to problems with the central tenet of Einstein's theory, that the laws of physics should hold no matter what the observer's velocity. It's difficult to introduce discrete structures without running into difficulties with special relativity, said Pullin. In a brief paper he wrote in 2014 with frequent collaborator Rodolfo Gambini, Pullin argued that making LQG compatible with special relativity necessitates interactions that are similar to those found in string theory. That the two approaches have something in common seemed likely to Pullin since a seminal discovery in the late 1990s by Juan Maldacena of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Maldacena matched up a gravitational theory in a so-called anti-de Sitter, or ADS, space-time with a field theory on the boundary of that space-time called a conformal field theory, or CFT. By using this ADS-CFT identification, the gravitational theory can be described by the better understood field theory. The full version of the duality is a conjecture, but it has a well-understood limiting case that string theory plays no role in. Because strings don't matter in this limiting case, it should be shared by any theory of quantum gravity. Pullin sees this as a contact point. Hermann Verlinde, a theoretical physicist at Princeton who frequently works on string theory, finds it plausible that methods from LQG can help illuminate the gravity side of the duality. In a recent paper, Verlinde looked at ADS-CFT in a simplified model with only two dimensions of space and one of time, or 2 plus 1, as physicists say. He found that the ADS space can be described by a network like those used in LQG. Even though the construction presently only works in 2 plus 1, it offers a new way to think about gravity. Verlinde hopes to generalize the model to higher dimensions. Loop quantum gravity has been seen too narrowly. My approach is to be inclusive. It's much more intellectually forward-looking, he said. But even having successfully combined LQG methods with string theory to make headway in anti-de Sitter space, the question remains, how successful is that combination? Anti-de Sitter spacetimes have a negative cosmological constant, a number that describes the large-scale geometry of the universe. Our universe has a positive one. We just don't inhabit the mathematical construct that is ADS space. Verlinde is pragmatic. One idea is that, for a positive cosmological constant, one needs a totally new theory, he said. Then the question is how different that theory is going to look. ADS is, at the moment, the best hint for the structure we are looking for. And then we have to find the twist to get a positive cosmological constant. He thinks it's time well spent. Though ADS doesn't describe our world, it will teach us some lessons that will guide us where to go. Verlinde and Pullin both point to another chance for the string theory and loop quantum gravity communities to come together. The mysterious fate of information that falls into a black hole. In 2012, four researchers based at UC Santa Barbara highlighted an internal contradiction in the prevailing theory. They argued that requiring a black hole to let information escape would destroy the delicate structure of empty space around the black hole's horizon, thereby creating a highly energetic barrier, a black hole firewall. This firewall, however, is incompatible with the equivalence principle that underlies general relativity, which holds that observers can't tell whether they've crossed the horizon. The incompatibility roiled string theorists, who thought they understood black hole information and now must revisit their notebooks. But this isn't a conundrum only for string theorists. This whole discussion about the black hole firewalls took place mostly within the string theory community, which I don't understand, Verlinde said. These questions about quantum information and entanglement and how to construct a mathematical Hilbert space, that's exactly what people in loop quantum gravity have been working on for a long time. Meanwhile, in a development that went unnoted by much of the string community, the barrier once posed by supersymmetry and extra dimensions has fallen as well. A group around Thomas Thiemann at Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany, has extended LQG to higher dimensions and included supersymmetry, both of which were formerly the territory of string theory. More recently, Norbert Bodendorfer, a former student of Thiemann's, who is now at the University of Warsaw, has applied methods of LQG's loop quantization to anti-de Sitter space. He argues that LQG can be useful for the ADS-CFT duality in situations where string theorists don't know how to perform gravitational computations. Bodendorfer feels that the former chasm between string theory and LQG is fading away. On some occasions, I've had the impression that string theorists knew very little about LQG and didn't want to talk about it, he said. But the younger people in string theory, they are very open-minded. They are very interested in what is going on at the interface. The biggest difference is in how we define our questions, said Verlinda. It's more sociological than scientific, unfortunately. He doesn't think the two approaches are in conflict. I've always viewed string theory and loop quantum gravity as parts of the same description. LQG is a method. It's not a theory. It's a method to think of quantum mechanics and geometry. It's a method that string theorists can use and are actually using. These things are not incompatible. Not everyone is so convinced. Moshe Rosali, a string theorist at the University of British Columbia, remains skeptical of LQG. The reason why I personally don't work on LQG is the issue with special relativity, he said. If your approach does not respect the symmetries of special relativity from the outset, then you basically need a miracle to happen at one of your intermediate steps. Still, Rosali said, some of the mathematical tools developed in LQG might come in handy. I don't think that there is any likelihood that string theory and LQG are going to converge to some middle ground, he said. But the methods are what people normally care about, and these are similar enough. The mathematical methods could have some overlap. Not everyone on the LQG side expects the two will merge either. Carlo Rovelli, a physicist at the University of Marseille and a founding father of LQG, believes his field ascendant. The string planet is infinitely less arrogant than 10 years ago, especially after the bitter disappointment of the non-appearance of supersymmetric particles, he said. It is possible that the two theories could be parts of a common solution, but I myself think it is unlikely. String theory seems to me to have failed to deliver what it had promised in the 80s, and is one of the many "nice idea, but nature is not like that" that dot the history of science. I do not really understand how people can still have hope in it. For Pullen, declaring victory seems premature. There are LQG people now saying, "We are the only game in town." I don't subscribe to this way of arguing. I think both theories are vastly incomplete. Second, A Fight for the Soul of Science, by Natalie Walchover. Physicists typically think they need philosophers and historians of science like birds need ornithologists, said the Nobel laureate David Gross to a room full of philosophers, historians, and physicists last month in Munich, Germany, paraphrasing Richard Feynman. But desperate times call for desperate measures. Fundamental physics faces a problem, Gross explained, one dire enough to call for outsiders' perspectives. I'm not sure that we don't need each other at this point in time, he said. It was the opening session of a 3-day workshop held in a Romanesque-style lecture hall at Ludwig Maximilian University, or LMU Munich, 1 year after George Ellis and Joe Silk, two white-haired physicists now sitting in the front row, called for such a conference in an incendiary opinion piece in Nature. 100 attendees had descended on a land with a celebrated tradition in both physics and the philosophy of science to wage what Ellis and Silk declared a battle for the heart and soul of physics. The crisis, as Ellis and Silk tell it, is the wildly speculative nature of modern physics theories, which they say reflects a dangerous departure from the scientific method. Many of today's theorists, chief among them the proponents of string theory and the multiverse hypothesis, appear convinced of their ideas on the grounds that they are beautiful or logically compelling, despite the impossibility of testing them. Ellis and Silk accuse these theorists of moving the goalposts of science and blurring the line between physics and pseudoscience. The imprimatur of science should be awarded only to a theory that is testable, Ellis and Silk wrote, thereby disqualifying most of the leading theories of the past 40 years. Only then can we defend science from attack. They were reacting, in part, to the controversial ideas of Richard David, an Austrian philosopher whose 2013 book, String Theory and the Scientific Method, identified three kinds of non-empirical evidence that David says can help build trust in scientific theories absent empirical data. David, a researcher at LMU Munich, answered Ellis and Silk's battle cry and assembled far-flung scholars anchoring all sides of the argument for the high-profile event. Gross, a supporter of string theory who won the 2004 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on the force that glues atoms together, kicked off the workshop by asserting that the problem lies not with physicists, but with a fact of nature, one that we have been approaching inevitably for four centuries. The dogged pursuit of a fundamental theory governing all forces of nature requires physicists to inspect the universe more and more closely, to examine, for instance, the atoms within matter, the protons and neutrons within those atoms, and the quarks within those protons and neutrons. But the zooming in demands ever more energy, and the difficulty and cost of building new machines increases exponentially relative to the energy requirement, Gross said. It hasn't been a problem so much for the last 400 years, where we've gone from centimeters to millions of a millionth of a millionth of a centimeter. The current resolving power of the Large Hadron Collider, or LHC, in Switzerland, he said. We've gone very far, but this energy squared is killing us. As we approach the practical limits of our ability to probe nature's underlying principles, the minds of theorists have wandered far beyond the tiniest observable distances and highest possible energies. Strong clues indicate that the truly fundamental constituents of the universe lie at a distance scale 10 million billion times smaller than the resolving power of the LHC. This is the domain of nature that string theory, a candidate theory of everything, attempts to describe. But it's a domain that no one has the faintest idea how to access. The problem also hampers physicists' quest to understand the universe on a cosmic scale. No telescope will ever manage to peer past our universe's cosmic horizon and glimpse the other universes posited by the multiverse hypothesis. Yet modern theories of cosmology lead logically to the possibility that our universe is just one of many. Whether the fault lies with theorists for getting carried away or with nature for burying its best secrets, the conclusion is the same. Theory has detached itself from experiment. The objects of theoretical speculation are now too far away, too small, too energetic, or too far in the past to reach or rule out with our earthly instruments. So what is to be done? As Ellis and Silk wrote, physicists, philosophers, and other scientists should hammer out a new narrative for the scientific method that can deal with the scope of modern physics. The issue in confronting the next step, said Gross, is not one of ideology, but strategy. What is the most useful way of doing science? Over three mild winter days, scholars grappled with the meaning of theory, confirmation, and truth, how science works, and whether, in this day and age, philosophy should guide research in physics, or the other way around. Over the course of these pressing yet timeless discussions, a degree of consensus took shape. Throughout history, the rules of science have been written on the fly, only to be revised to fit evolving circumstances. The ancients believed they could reason their way towards scientific truth. Then, in the 17th century, Isaac Newton ignited modern science by breaking with this rationalist philosophy, adopting instead the empiricist view that scientific knowledge derives only from empirical observation. In other words, a theory must be proved experimentally to enter the book of knowledge. But what requirements must an untested theory meet to be considered scientific? Theorists guide the scientific enterprise by dreaming up the ideas to be put to the test and then interpreting the experimental results. What keeps theorists within the bounds of science? Today, most physicists judge the soundness of a theory by using the Austrian-British philosopher Karl Popper's rule of thumb. In the 1930s, Popper drew a line between science and non-science in comparing the work of Albert Einstein with that of Sigmund Freud. Einstein's theory of general relativity, which cast the force of gravity as curves in space and time, made risky predictions. Ones that, if they hadn't succeeded so brilliantly, would have failed miserably, falsifying the theory. But Freudian psychoanalysis was slippery. Any fault of your mother's could be worked into your diagnosis. The theory wasn't falsifiable, and so Popper decided it wasn't science. Critics accused string theory and the multiverse hypothesis, as well as cosmic inflation, the leading theory of how the universe began, of falling on the wrong side of Popper's line of demarcation. To borrow the title of the Columbia University physicist Peter Voigt's 2006 book on string theory, these ideas are not even wrong, say critics. In their editorial, Ellis and Silk invoked the spirit of Popper. A theory must be falsifiable to be scientific. But, as many in Munich were surprised to learn, falsification is no longer the reigning philosophy of science. Massimo Pigliucci, a philosopher at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, pointed out that falsifiability is woefully inadequate as a separator of science and non-science, as Popper himself recognized. Astrology, for instance, is falsifiable. Indeed, it has been falsified ad nauseam. And yet, it isn't science. Physicists' preoccupation with Popper is really something that needs to stop, Pigliucci said. We need to talk about current philosophy of science. We don't talk about something that was current 50 years ago. Nowadays, as several philosophers of the workshop said, Popperian falsificationism has been supplanted by Bayesian confirmation theory, or Bayesianism, a modern framework based on the 18th century probability theory of the English statistician and minister Thomas Bayes. Bayesianism allows for the fact that modern scientific theories typically make claims far beyond what can be directly observed. No one has ever seen an atom, and so today's theories often resist a falsified-unfalsified dichotomy. Instead, trust in a theory often falls somewhere along a continuum, sliding up or down between 0 and 100% as new information becomes available. The Bayesian framework is much more flexible than Popper's theory, said Stephen Hartman, a Bayesian philosopher at LMU. It also connects nicely to the psychology of reasoning. Gross concurred, saying that upon learning about Bayesian confirmation theory from David's book, he felt somewhat like the Molière character who said, "Oh my God, I've been talking prose all my life." Another advantage of Bayesianism, Hartman said, is that it is enabling philosophers like David to figure out how this non-empirical evidence fits in or can be fit in. David, who is 49, mild-mannered, and smiley with floppy brown hair, started his career as a theoretical physicist. In the late 1990s, during a stint at UC Berkeley, a hub of string theory research, David became fascinated by how confident many string theorists seemed to be that they were on the right track, despite string theory's complete lack of empirical support. Why do they trust the theory? He recalls wondering. Do they have different ways of thinking about it than the canonical understanding? String theory says that elementary particles have dimensionality when viewed close up, appearing as wiggling loops or strings and membranes at nature's highest zoom level. According to the theory, extra dimensions also materialize in the fabric of space itself. The different vibrational modes of the strings in this higher dimensional space give rise to the spectrum of particles that make up the observable world. In particular, one of the vibrational modes fits the profile of the graviton, a hypothetical particle associated with the force of gravity. Thus, string theory unifies gravity, now described by Einstein's theory of general relativity, with the rest of particle physics. However, string theory, which has its roots in ideas developed in the late 1960s, has made no testable predictions about the observable universe. To understand why so many researchers trusted anyways, David signed up for some classes in philosophy of science, and upon discovering how little study had been devoted to the phenomenon, he switched fields. In the early 2000s, he identified three non-empirical arguments that generate trust in string theory among its proponents. First, there appears to be only one version of string theory capable of achieving unification in a consistent way, though it has many different mathematical representations. Furthermore, no other theory of everything capable of unifying all the fundamental forces has been found, despite immense effort. A rival approach called loop quantum gravity describes gravity at the quantum scale, but makes no attempt to unify it with the other forces. This no alternatives argument, colloquially known as string theory is the only game in town, boosts theorists' confidence that few or no other possible unifications of the four fundamental forces exist, making it more likely that string theory is the right approach. Second, string theory grew out of the standard model, the accepted empirically validated theory incorporating all known fundamental particles and forces, apart from gravity, in a single mathematical structure. And the standard model also had no alternatives during its formative years. This meta-inductive argument, as David calls it, buttresses the no-alternatives argument by showing that it has worked before in similar contexts, countering the possibility that physicists simply aren't clever enough to find alternatives that exist. The third non-empirical argument is that string theory has unexpectedly delivered explanations for several other theoretical problems aside from the unification problem it was intended to address. The staunch string theorist, Joe Polchinski, of UC Santa Barbara, presented several examples of these unexpected explanatory interconnections, as David has termed them, in a paper read in Munich in his absence. String theory explains the entropy of black holes, for example, and in a surprising discovery that has caused a surge of research in the past 15 years, is mathematically translatable into a theory of particles, such as the theory describing the nuclei of atoms. Polchinski concludes that, considering how far away we are from the exceptionally fine grain of nature's fundamental distance scale, we should count ourselves lucky. String theory exists, and we have found it. Polchinski also used David's non-empirical arguments to calculate the Bayesian odds that the multiverse exists as 94%, a value that has been ridiculed by the internet's vocal multiverse critics. One concern when including non-empirical arguments in Bayesian confirmation theory, David acknowledged in his talk, is that it opens the floodgates to abandoning all scientific principles. One can come up with all kinds of non-empirical virtues when arguing in favor of a pet idea. Clearly, the risk is there, and clearly one has to be careful about this kind of reasoning, David said. But acknowledging that non-empirical confirmation is part of science and has been part of science for quite some time provides a better basis for having that discussion than pretending that it wasn't there and only implicitly using it and then saying I haven't done it. Once it's out in the open, one can discuss the pros and cons of those arguments within a specific context. The trash heap of history is littered with beautiful theories. The Danish historian of cosmology, Helga Krag, who detailed a number of these failures in his 2011 Higher Speculations, spoke in Munich about the 19th century vortex theory of atoms. This Victorian theory of everything, developed by the Scots Peter Tait and Lord Kelvin, postulated that atoms are microscopic vortexes in the ether, the fluid medium that was believed at the time to fill space. Hydrogen, oxygen, and all other atoms were, deep down, just different types of vortical knots. At first, the theory seemed to be highly promising, Krag said. People were fascinated by the richness of the mathematics, which could keep mathematicians busy for centuries, as was said at the time. Alas, atoms are not vortexes. The ether does not exist, and theoretical beauty is not always truth. Except sometimes it is. Rationalism guided Einstein toward his theory of relativity, which he believed in wholeheartedly on rational grounds before it was ever tested. I hold it true that pure thought can grasp reality, as the ancients dreamed, Einstein said in 1933, years after his theory had been confirmed by observations of starlight bending around the sun. The question for the philosopher is, without experiments, is there any way to distinguish between the non-empirical virtues of vortex theory and those of Einstein's theory? Can we ever really trust a theory on non-empirical grounds? In discussions on the third afternoon of the workshop, the LMU philosopher Radin Dardashti asserted that David's philosophy specifically aims to pinpoint which non-empirical arguments should carry weight, allowing scientists to make an assessment that is not based on simplicity, which is not based on beauty. Davidian assessment is meant to be more objective than these measures, Dardashti explained, and more revealing of a theory's true promise. Gross said David has described beautifully the strategies physicists use to gain confidence in a speculation, a new idea, a new theory. You mean confidence that it's true? Asked Peter Achenstein, an 80-year-old philosopher and historian of science at Johns Hopkins University. Confidence that it's useful? Confidence that... Let's give an operational definition of confidence. I will continue to work on it, Gross said. That's pretty low, Achenstein said. Not for science, Gross said. That's the question that matters. Craig pointed out that even Popper saw value in the kind of thinking that motivates string theorists today. Popper called speculation that did not yield testable predictions metaphysics, but he considered such activity worthwhile since it might become testable in the future. This was true of atomic theory, which many 19th-century physicists feared would never be empirically confirmed. Popper was not a naive Popperian, Craig said. If a theory is not falsifiable, Craig said, channeling Popper, it should not be given up. We have to wait. But several workshop participants raised qualms about Bayesian confirmation theory and about David's non-empirical arguments in particular. Carlo Rovelli, a proponent of loop quantum gravity, string theory's rival, who was based at Aix-Marseille University in France, objected that Bayesian confirmation theory does not allow for an important distinction that exists in science between theories that scientists are certain about and those that are still being tested. The Bayesian confirmation that atoms exist is essentially 100% as a result of countless experiments. But Rovelli says that the degree of confirmation of atomic theory shouldn't even be measured in the same units as that of string theory. String theory is not, say, 10% as confirmed as atomic theory. The two have different statuses entirely. The problem with David's non-empirical confirmation is that it muddles the point, Rovelli said. And of course, some string theorists are happy of muddling it this way, because they can then say that string theory is confirmed, equivocating. The German physicist Sabine Hofsenfelder, in her talk, argued that progress in fundamental physics very often comes from abandoning cherished prejudices, such as perhaps the assumption that the forces of nature must be unified. Echoing this, Rovelli said David's idea of non-empirical confirmation forms an obstacle to this possibility of progress, because it bases our credence on our own previous credences. It takes away one of the tools, maybe the soul itself, of scientific thinking. He continued, which is, do not trust your own thinking. The Munich proceedings will be compiled and published, probably as a book, in 2017. As for what was accomplished, one important outcome, according to Ellis, was an acknowledgement by participating string theorists that the theory is not confirmed, in the sense of being verified. David Gross made his position clear. David's criteria are good for justifying working on the theory, not for saying the theory is validated in a non-empirical way, Ellis wrote in an email. That seems to me a good position, and explicitly stating that is progress. In considering how theorists should proceed, many attendees expressed the view that work on string theory and other as yet untestable ideas should continue. Keep speculating, Achenstein wrote in an email after the workshop, but give your motivation for speculating, give your explanations, but admit that they are only possible explanations. Maybe someday things will change, Achenstein added, and the speculations will become testable. And maybe not. Maybe never. We may never know for sure the way the universe works at all distances and all times. But perhaps you can narrow the live possibilities to just a few, he said. I think that would be some progress. You're listening to Quantum Magazine's Science Podcast, with music by Poddington Bear. I'm Leia Alfonso. For news, interviews, graphics, and more, visit quantummagazine.org.